It is 7:30, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Howard Putter, Rich Grady, and Jerry Haynes. Howard Putter is an orthopedic surgeon, now retired, and with WPSR. I should say that all three of you are with WPSR, which is Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. Rich Grady is a who was just on the show a couple weeks ago, is a pediatric urologist at Children's Hospital and vice president of WPSR. And Jerry Haynes, who has been on the show before, is a nurse consultant. She is a board member and past president of WPSR and a past national PSR board member. She is also an organizer for educational trips to the Middle East and has led delegations to Iraq, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Palestine, and Syria. And she was the organizer of a 9-member delegation that just returned from Gaza in May of this year, of which all three of our guests were participants, members of that delegation. So Howard, Rich, and Jerry, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Let's start out, if one of you would briefly tell us a little bit about WPSR.
Sure. WPSR stands for Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. We're the Washington chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility, which is an organization which will actually be celebrating its 50th anniversary next year. And the intent of the organization at its founding was nuclear abolition, so the prevention of nuclear war. The organization is also very active in issues around protection of the environment, environmental degradation, and the prevention of toxicants affecting our human health, as well as the health of the planet. The organization, because of its focus on nuclear abolition, has also really embraced issues around peace and justice, which brings us to, you know, why we're here this morning.
All right.
So in 1993, WPSR made its first journey into the Middle East at the invitation of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War chapter in Israel. And we met on that journey a gentleman named Iyad Sarraj, who is the head of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program in Gaza City. Since then, we have visited back and forth in Gaza with Iyad Sarraj, and he's come here, we've been there. And last year in October, we took a delegation into Gaza to serve as medical people in the Gaza Strip. We were there for 5 days in October and found that those people who came in to serve there were highly, highly needed and welcomed. And so this time we took back more medical practitioners who worked in Gaza. And the purpose for that was not just to do the work, but to give support to our colleagues in Gaza, people who are not able to move freely back and forth between Gaza and an external environment where they might pick up more skills or have further continuing education. And also because the population of Gaza is so highly traumatized, just to give support to the people in general by saying that people from the outside world want to come in and visit them. We were welcomed actually by the people of Israel who helped us to get into Gaza, and we found that we also had colleagues there who were willing and able to help us find admission to Gaza. Howard?
Well, I was asked to say why I went to Gaza. And I was born in 1949. Israel was born in 1948. I'm Jewish, and Israel and the Holocaust have always been an important part of my life. I have no doubt that true peace and cooperation between the Israelis and Palestinians will benefit both beyond belief, and transform the entire Middle East and probably the world. It was a chance to see with my own eyes what is going on and just hearing tales of what's going on from other people. It was a chance to really experience the Middle East and Gaza in particular. It was also a chance to let Palestinians, and in particular my orthopedic colleagues, know that they have colleagues around the world that care about them. They are, as Jerry said, they're extremely isolated. They're cut off from learning opportunities. They're cut off from opportunities to acquire modern equipment, learn modern technique. And it was, I felt terribly, they were terribly appreciative to have a colleague from the United States in particular come to support them emotionally and spiritually. The Palestinians we did meet really felt that they wanted peace. They yearned for peace, and they knew how much they would benefit from peace. We also met many wonderful Israelis who truly understood what was happening and genuinely wanted peace, were willing to work for peace, were willing to sacrifice for peace, and realized how much they and the world would benefit from peace as well. So there were people on both sides that truly were of like mind, even though they really could not connect since Gaza is so isolated. But you could see the yearning for peace both on the Israeli and the Palestinian side. So it was a wonderful opportunity, and I thank Jerry for organizing it.
Because the Gaza Community Mental Health Program is our sponsor, our host, when we're in Gaza, they set up for us these very intricate schedules of where people are going to go and how they're going to serve, and they give me an opportunity to teach about grief and bereavement, which is, of course, widespread among the people of Gaza, all of whom have been traumatized both by the siege, which is ongoing under the political domain of Hamas, and the Israeli response to Hamas, and from Operation Cast Lead, when 1,393 people were killed and over 5,000 people were injured in December 2008 and January of 2009, and the constant threat of further violence, both within and from without Gaza.
From my standpoint, I actually, my opportunity to get into Gaza was really a direct result of my wife, who has been active overseas in medical missions. She's a urologist, and she was over with Jerry, and it's actually, I think this is her fourth time into Gaza. And she, when she was there the last time, she was doing urologic work, but she really appreciated that they needed more help and perhaps specialist help. And so when she came back, she said, boy, they'd need a pediatric urologist. And so I've done some work in various places overseas and agreed to go over. And it was, I think, the one of the things that I was struck by is, despite the fact that here are people who are largely in this big open-air prison that was, you know, in fact, there are probably prisons in the United States that are easier to get in and out of, there was a real resilience and an interest in what we had to bring. The healthcare system over there is largely two-tier. It's there's a public system, and it is for anyone who's done any work overseas in a big public hospital, it's limited resources, more demand than they can take care of. It's kind of like being in a giant open-air bazaar because there's all sorts of people running around. And the urologists, they were really interested in what we had to bring. One of the nice things about my profession is I don't need a lot of equipment, and which was good because they're really limited there. It's very difficult for them to get any sort of major supplies. Even basic things like good suture is in short supply there. So you have to make do with what you have. It's kind of a MacGyver meets medicine approach. And even with that, there was, you know, a real kind of esprit de corps and celebrating the joy in life, even in that situation.
The orthopedic surgeons that I met there, and there were 16 orthopedic surgeons that are taking care of 1.6 million people, were still visibly traumatized. They had still not emotionally recovered from the invasion that had happened, where they talked about doing amputations in the hallway. I think they were clearly burned out, and they were clearly still trying to recover and to get back on their feet. But our task is really not to blame or to argue about who's right and who's wrong, or, you know, to argue the justification of the Cast-Lead invasion or the rockets, but it's to work for peace and to try to just realize that peace is in the benefit of everybody, and that the arguing of the right and the wrong and is not of any use to anybody. But the only useful thing that can be done in Gaza is to work for peace and not to get stuck in arguing about, you know, who's right and who's wrong and who's at fault. So for the sake of the 1.6 million people who live in Gaza and the million plus people that live on the West Bank, I mean, and for the Israelis themselves, I mean, the Israelis have a huge stake in peace. They're expending enormous resources and a lot of emotional capital in this conflict as well. So it's a two-sided suffering that's going on in the middle, in Israel and Palestine.
Two things that were pertinent in this visit to me. One is that we went to the women's empowerment clinics and talked to women. And during the time before Hamas, women were given this new role, both in government and in the society, or not given the role, but began to take a different kind of role in learning to become part of the government and becoming better educators and speaking up for the children and for their whole family situation. And so the women empowerment clinics have really added to the sense of the power of women in Gaza. Secondly, there's in Gaza this tunnel economy, and we were able one day to go down and visit the tunnels that go between Rafah and Egypt. There are somewhere between 400 and 500 tunnels now that go down 15 meters or more and run then horizontally into Egypt and come up in private homes or in hidden places. Those tunnels are periodically cut off both by bombing from Israel and by explosions from Gaza. And the fellow that we talked to on the day we were there said there were probably 50 functional tunnels. Since the flotilla disaster on May 31st and a lot of international pressure, Egypt has opened the Rafah border, and it remains open now. So I'm not sure what's happening to that tunnel economy since we were there. But we know that most of the fresh fruit and a lot of the hardware that was coming into Gaza was coming in through the tunnels. And one of the things that we saw that was particularly of concern for the public health was the use of small, heavily polluting generators. So walking through Gaza City, in front of every small business, there was a generator. And that has to do with the lack of electricity coming into Gaza, both from Israel and Egypt and from the internal supply area. And so the incidence of asthma among the children of Gaza is supposedly skyrocketing. The second major public health thing that we saw, other than the mental health problems that are associated with the trauma that they've sustained, is the water supply. And because of the electricity supply and because of the sewage treatment plant problems, we saw free-flowing, untreated or partially treated sewage flowing into the Mediterranean Sea, polluting the sea and causing degradation of the soil as well as the water. And, Rich, maybe you would talk about the problem with fishing and the blockade to one of the primary sources of income.
Sure. You know, that was one of the things that there was... I think really struck all of us is the infrastructure of the place has been affected. Like Jerry was saying, you could see one of our tours, you know, the sewage just draining into the sea. And one of the issues with the blockade is the fishermen are only allowed to go out, I think it's, 3 miles from the shore, which effectively really limits their ability to do any significant fishing. And then you're basically fishing in what are largely polluted waters. So you can imagine, you know, the problems with that. And trying to make your livelihood as well as, you know, what you're bringing back for people to eat. And this is, I think, one of the things that struck me when I was being driven around. The water shortage has resulted in basically privatization of water supply. So many people now actually have to buy their fresh water which is, you know, another hardship because with the tunnel economy, the price of everything is essentially tripled. And then you have to, you know, buy your basic necessities as well. And so there are certainly economic hardships that continue to be an issue for everyone who's living in Gaza. And it's not like they have a choice of whether they can come or go because it's the getting in and out of that whole area is, you know, so problematic.
In the last month, the siege has been modified somewhat so that more goods are now supposedly coming into Gaza. Things like mayonnaise can get in now. But a primary problem is that there is no lifting of what can come out of Gaza. So between a water problem and a problem with putting out goods and services from Gaza, the level of unemployment is somewhere between 39% and 89%, depending on who you listen to. But that level of unemployment is reflected in frustration in homes and probably a significant rise in in-home violence and in-home pain. People who sell vegetables don't give vegetables to their children because they can't afford to buy them. It's a very circular problem of economic disaster and personal sorrow.
Well, you know, as we're saying, Gaza is an ecological disaster, but it strikes me ironically that at this point, there's the disaster of having 1.5 million people in a very small area, and now they talk proudly about going to 3 million people in the next 15 years. So you've got this kind of irony or the conflict between, you know, lack of infrastructure, lack of water, lack of sewage, but then doubling your population. And it just doesn't make any realistic sense to do that. So there's so many things that are going on there that just don't seem totally reasonable or logical.
Yeah, I think that's a good example of how when people don't see an effective political strategy, you know, they're looking at some long-term strategy, and you know, part of what you hear is, well, we'll just continue to have families, and pretty soon we'll just be really big, and then I think we'll have to be dealt with. Yeah, and that's the other thing that I was really struck by is the significant number of Gazans are, you know, relatively politically motivated only by the fact that they want to figure out, well, what can I do to make sure I've got food and security for my family? But other than that, how that shows up, whether I heard from people who were speaking to me who said, maybe better if the Israelis took over, you know, Gaza again because we were happier under that regime, versus some who said, well, maybe it's better under Hamas because they are at least not politically corrupt. You know, so you had this whole range, but basically the bottom line was people just wanted to find a system that worked so they could get food for the table and make sure that they had some sort of livelihood. And that was kind of a common belief. And, you know, someone told me there that apparently only 25% of the people voted in the last election. So you've got the majority of people, you know, under a government that only a minority elected. It actually kind of reminded me of other countries.
Well, whether you live in Gaza or whether you live in Bellevue, Washington, which is sort of at the opposite ends of the spectrum, we all have the same wants. We all want to be happy. And it was just painful to see people of all different ages that were in Gaza that were just trapped and felt like the doctors that you would talk to that would say, you know, we don't have any fun anymore. We don't have any place we can go to relax and just have fun. Fun was something that they remembered in their past and they felt was no longer possible for them. And we met kids. When I say kids, you know, 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, that just felt like they had no future. And we met, and it was interesting for me to meet 60-year-olds who felt that the end of life was at 60. Whereas in America, we feel like at 60 is where you know, you still have lots of things to look forward to. And in Gaza, people felt they would be mostly dead or at the end of their life at age 60. So it's a very different perspective, and it was really painful to see young people and middle-aged people that felt like they had no future, that hope or happiness wasn't going to be part of their existence.
One of the really impressive people that we met in Gaza was not a Gazan, but John Ging, who's an Irishman and head of the United Nations Relief Works Association, UNRWA. And he talked about how under the time of Operation Cast Lead, he was speaking out. And if anyone wants to Google him, there are lots of YouTube videos of John Ging speaking out about the situation in Gaza. He's extremely articulate and has many things to say about how Hamas might conduct themselves, how the Hamas-Fatah conflict could be resolved to the betterment of the people of Gaza, but most specifically how the imprisonment of a civilian population needs to be relieved, and that the imprisonment of those civilian people needs to end. He has lots to say about how those people might be able to trade freely back and forth to the betterment of their civilization, because the actual threat of weaponry is controllable by an exquisite Israeli security system. Certainly the most detailed security system that I've experienced in traveling in the Middle East.
I think one of the stories that really struck me while I was over there, my wife and I were seeing some patients in one of the hospitals, and of course, the majority of people there speak a little bit of English, but mostly Arabic. And this is a gentleman who is an Arab English teacher who actually hadn't had work for years. And we didn't know that when we initially got to meet him. Delightful man, and every day that he showed up, he seemed a little bit happier, and, you know, he had his clothing kept on getting, you know, a little bit nicer and better pressed, and as the we came closer to the end of our visit there, he came in, and my wife was talking to him, and he said, you know, and he was making a comment that his wife had said, "I've never seen you this happy in years." And in fact, he literally, because there's so little work to be had there, he hadn't been working for years and hadn't found much of an excuse to get out of bed. He was, you know, not shaving in the morning and doing a lot of things because, you know, he really saw, you know, what was the point. So, you know, I was happy to be part of, you know, bringing a little bit more purpose into his life and really recognize the dilemma that they have there, because there are a lot of good people who, you know, want something to do and can't because of the situation. You know, it's a little bit like, I guess, you know, serving a life sentence. With no, you know, opportunity to know when is this whole thing going to end.
Certainly pressure from the international community is part of the reason that there has been some lifting of the intensity of the siege. Certainly not enough lifting of the intensity of that siege. And the disaster created there in Gaza is man-made or people-made, not a natural disaster. It's not a hurricane or a tornado or something like that, but we're paying for this siege, and part of our tax dollars help to support this siege, so we need to think about the ramifications of what we do with our money, as well as how that money is used once it gets to the Middle East. And just now, the conflict between Fatah and Hamas has resulted in a lessening even further of electricity flowing into Gaza, so that while we were there, we were seeing cuts of 4 to 8 hours per day, and now there is a cut from between 12 and 24 hours a day. And, of course, the temperatures are rising there now, and those cuts in electricity for people who don't have generators means no refrigeration and really a disastrous situation in a very hot and arid country.
Well, you know, as a physician, you realize that the DNA of the Palestinians and the Israelis is about as close as it gets. And it was ironic and somewhat uplifting to be in the presence of John Ging, an Irishman who has been in Ireland and was part of the peace process in Ireland, So you realize that peace is possible between brothers, and that if peace could occur, peace has seemed to evolved in Northern Ireland and Ireland, and if peace could come to the Middle East, the benefit would be enormous to everybody. And if people could just work for peace instead of trying to be attached to the positions that they hold of who's right and wrong, it would just benefit firstly the people living there and then the whole Middle East, as John Ging said, and then the whole world. So that's our hope.
One of the young women that we met, whose name is Sahar Salem, was a translator in one of the classes that I taught last October, and then she came to visit with us again this year. And John Ging pointed to her and said, "This is the next president of the Palestinian people." She's only 23 years old, extremely impressive young woman who now is applying for a visa to come here. So, Mick, maybe you can have her on this coming fall.
Yeah, it was interesting in meeting her. And I think one of the things that was interesting to see is because the United Nations has been so active in Gaza, a lot of people feel that the issues around gender inequalities are actually less in Gaza than they are in a lot of other places, because the women have really been empowered to get involved, get educated, become politically active. And so, you know, it's funny how some of these things evolve. And so, it would be great to see Sahara as, you know, really politically active, because she is an amazing woman.
So only a few minutes left and not enough time to really answer this, but to those people that you read in the paper that respond, that those people over there have always been at war, there's no hope for them. What's your response to that?
Well, that's absolutely false. If you look historically, Jews were kicked out of Spain in 1492 at the time of the Spanish Inquisition. Prior to the Spanish Inquisition, for several centuries, Spain was the shining light of the world, because they had, there was the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages going on around them, and the Muslims and the Jews and the Christians were all living in harmony in Spain and creating this wonderful civilization. When the Jews were kicked out in 1492, a lot of Jews emigrated to Northern Africa and to the area of the Arabic countries, and were really lived in harmony in those countries for centuries, up until 1948. So, I mean, historically, there have been conflicts going back to the beginning of the Bible, and those are well documented in both the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim Bibles. However, historically, Jews and Muslims have, and Arabs have lived well together, and there's no reason that they can't. So I think that's an argument that's often used, and I think it's an argument that has no merit.
Yeah, we actually had an opportunity to go to Haifa, which is one of the areas in Israel that's been recognized for political tolerance, and there are good examples of how different cultures really do work well together, and Haifa is one of those. They've got an Arabic population and a Jewish population and a small Christian population, and they showed that it is possible.
All right. We are just about out of time. How can people find out more about WPSR and perhaps future delegations?
www.wpsr.org on the internet, or you call the office 206-547. My mind just went blank.
I'd say go to the website.
This is a senior moment.
All right. So we'll just lead people to the website. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank all three of you for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
How often do we call that?
There's a wonderful book called Ornament of the World.
Yeah, I've got that book.
Danny, 547-26.
I don't call that number.
30.
All right. We have just been speaking with Howard Putter, Rich Grady, and Jerry Haynes, all three with Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. And if you would like more info about their organization, www.wpsr.org.